From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Terry Hill Spinall.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll catch a ride with a mobile health clinic.
If kids start taking responsibility for their health, that it actually spills over into other areas of their life.
We'll meet teens taking charge of their own well-being in health and in finance.
Seeing my mom struggle is a huge portion of why I try to control my financial life as much as possible.
And a local filmmaker reflects on his childhood a little differently after rewatching old home movies.
You know, if memories are food for the soul, home movies are the crumbs we drop to find our way home.
The CamFest's closing night movie, Memories to Light. That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. If you're taking BART home this evening, you might notice a few more wheels in your car, bicycle wheels. Today is the first day of a week-long experiment to see if bikes and rush hour can coexist. KALW's Isabel Angel rode BART this morning, and she brings back this report about how things went.
Usually, bikes aren't allowed on San Francisco-bound BART trains during peak morning commute hours, or back to the East Bay in the evening. And they're not allowed in the 19th Street or 12th Street stations during commute hours. But this week, BART has opened up all hours and stations to bikers. It's a trial period, and to make it work, BART officials and cycling groups are urging riders to follow the rules. No bikes on the first three cars during peak hours, and no bikes on crowded trains ever.
And so we're asking all bicyclists to use common sense and courtesy.
Robert Rayburn is on the BART Board of Directors. I ran into him at the 19th Street station. He was wheeling his own bike around the station, making sure everything was going smoothly. He said he was excited to see how things go this week, but that people have to be patient.
The reality is that in many cases, we're not going to be able to open the floodgates and just allow hundreds more bikes on any one train. That won't work.
At least this morning, the common sense approach seemed to be working. In the hours I rode the train, from 7 to 8:30, I didn't see anyone shoving their bikes onto a packed car. It seemed like what hadn't been working was the ban. I talked with John Dillon back at the 19th Street station. It's a station that doesn't usually allow bikes during peak hours.
Yeah, usually I'd ride my bike to a station that's about 2 miles further away and then illegally put it on a train I'm not allowed to ride, try to keep it out of people's way, but I mean, I have to get to work, so.
So he brings his bike on BART even when he's not supposed to. But when I talked to him, Dillon had just let a crowded train pass by. He says he always waits for a car with more room, even if it means missing two or three trains. Keith McKinnon takes BART from El Cerrito Plaza to Embarcadero every day. He says he regularly sees bikes on trains they're not supposed to be on, but it doesn't bother him.
No, the bicyclists usually stay out of people's way. They're usually off on the side.
Of course, not everyone flaunts the ban. I talked to plenty of people who were excited to finally board with their bikes. Ronnie Hanning said that's why he took BART today.
I like riding my bike on the weekends, and why not, you know, commute for a week?
BART's already updating cars to make more space for bikes. The fleet will be fully modified by June. After this week, BART officials will meet with community members and survey commuters to decide whether they want to move forward with the next step, getting rid of the bike ban for good. For Cross Currents, I'm Isabel Angel.
For more transportation reporting, go to kalw.org. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The United States has one of the highest costs for healthcare in the world, but a new study suggests we just don't want to think about it. A survey in the journal Health Affairs finds that most people aren't interested in what their healthcare costs, at least not as much as they're interested in getting better. Even faced with high prices, we'd rather choose the more expensive care if we think it's going to be more effective. That picture gets even more complicated when you don't have health insurance to help cover those high costs. And that's an especially big problem for low-income young people. Kids are left without care for a variety of reasons: immigration status, homelessness, or gaps in public coverage. And when people don't get regular preventative care, a costly emergency room trip can end up costing the public 10 times as much. At least that's how much the Bay Area's Teen Health Van saves for every dollar it spends. The van's a local mobile clinic that provides basic care and counseling to low-income youth. In this piece from our archives, KALW's Jordan Katz climbs aboard to see how it works. And a note to our listeners, we've changed some of the names in the piece to protect patient privacy.
What's the quickest way to a child's heart? How about Harry Potter?
We need to get into Hogwarts tonight.
The staff at the Bay Area's Teen Health Van know that their patients are no exception. The movie drowns out any sounds coming from nearby exam rooms, helping preserve patient privacy.
What makes you think you can trust him?
Patients range from ages 10 to 25. Half are homeless. Most lack health insurance.
So the kids that we see typically have not had regular health care.
Dr. Seth Ammerman is a practicing pediatrician and medical director of the Teen Health Van. Regarding regular physicals,
often it's sporadic or they haven't had any in years even. So that what we do is provide comprehensive medical care.
With funding from the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Ammerman and his team launched the program in 1987. It's a one-stop mobile shop that travels to every nook and cranny of the Bay Area's underserved neighborhoods.
Any pain today, hon?
No.
Today, it's parked outside the Indo-Chinese housing development in San Francisco's Tenderloin. Melissa Nguyen, 21, is up next for her monthly checkup.
There are days I don't feel good having headaches and sleepless night.
Nguyen has no health insurance. She wandered into the van 3 years ago, complaining of a headache, and she kept coming back. Now, she says, she's a happier person overall.
Before, I kept to myself, and like when I don't feel good, I tend to be like, in my box, no one's entering it. And after I came onto this van, it's more like I felt much better.
She says the van's counselor has made a huge difference.
They actually made me feel like they've been there and they actually understand us and they're willing to help us one by one, one step at a time.
Patricia Soto Minder, the van's social worker, says she's on the lookout for certain psychosocial problems.
First of all, I do a psychosocial assessment to find out if the patient, I cover everything, you know, to find out if the patient is homeless, if the patient has any type of mental health issue.
Soto Minder says a lot of teens who come in feel isolated. Many have bounced between various foster homes and housing developments. Her role is to bridge the gap between patients and those around them who can help.
When we meet them, we're able to assess them and provide those resources that they're not in place. And if you mobilize those resources, that individual doesn't feel alone. And in that way, you can normalize their behavior, or you can move those resources that at that point the client needs.
The van has a comprehensive team that can provide virtually any kind of care. There's a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a social worker, and a physician's assistant. There's even a resident dietitian and fitness instructor. And what they don't have, says Dr. Ammerman, they team up with neighborhood organizations to provide.
So here's a Boys and Girls Club.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. Health van's here.
Okay.
Usual spot.
The Boys and Girls Club offers after-school arts and crafts. Down the street, the Tenderloin Children's Playground hosts a kitchen for cooking classes, a gym, and a veggie garden. All are part of a wellness program designed to keep kids coming back.
It's very important that we meet the adolescents' agenda or priorities, as well as ours. And, you know, we try to address them all. One thing that I found is that if kids start taking responsibility for their health, that it actually spills over into other areas of their life.
Sally Martinez's family has been coming to the health van for 8 years. She says her family is stuck in limbo between qualifying for federal aid and affording private health insurance.
We don't qualify for Medi-Cal, and it's just me and my husband working. It's like we make, according to them, too much, but we have 6 kids, you know, so it's hard.
And 3 of the 6 are in college. But the van has relieved some of the pressure and is now an important part of the Martinez's lives.
Mm-hmm. They know all the kids' names. They know me. Actually, I called him to make sure they were going to be here today. I have his cell phone number, so.
Sometimes people are shocked at that. Oh, you're giving teens your cell phone. But it's really interesting because it helps, I think, build trust with the kids and is a bonding thing with them. And it's extremely rare that they don't call me with an appropriate question.
Maybe it's the cell phone number. Maybe it's just that these underserved kids know that someone somewhere knows what they're going through. Whatever it is, the teen health van and its staff have given them a place to come home to. In San Francisco, I'm Jordan Katz for Cross Currents.
You'll find a link to the teen health van's schedule at our website. It's kalw.org. And we want to know how you're coping with the high cost of health care. You can give us a call at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to share your story on the air. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Learning how to navigate the healthcare system is just one of the very adult challenges that many teens face. Another is dealing with finances. We'll return now to our series Money Diaries, in which young people in Oakland talk about their relationship with money. Today's story comes from 17-year-old Kaylin Robinson.
I live with my mom, my auntie, my cousin, her son, 2 of them. And her boyfriend kind of stays there.
Kaylin lives in East Oakland in the house his grandmother owned. When she died, different family members tried to keep it up. Recently, his mom, who works for the city of Oakland, has taken on the house as her responsibility.
Taking over a house is like a huge deal. Like, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of time and, stress. I know because, you can see it in her face.
And that stress has changed the way he sees his own situation. Here's Kaylin.
It's Monday, 9:45 p.m. I am in the back of my house working out on my workout bench. Been jogging, I've been trying to get ready for football, and I gotta be independent. Do what you can. Work with what you can. A lot of police sirens. You kind of hear them often over here. I mean, it's kind of crazy. People just go about their lives like they don't notice it, and they don't notice the gunshots around here, but we all do.
It is 10:24 p.m. and I'm speaking with my mother. So, how do you feel about your financial life right now?
My financial life is not the best, but 2014, I'll be pretty much paid off majority of my bills. So, 2014, I should be pretty stable.
So how you feel about the whole situation with the grandma house?
Kind of stressful. We're behind. If we don't keep this, it's like we will have to find somewhere else to live. And, you know, I have other people that I'm responsible for besides yourself who is making your grandmother house their home.
So how do you manage, Mom?
Sometimes you got to rob Peter to pay Paul.
What does that mean?
Meaning that sometimes you have to be late. Sometimes you, instead of me having to give you money for lunch, I may have to use that money to pay a bill. Or sometimes I probably over my checking account. I go over it. Go over my, you know, and then be paying all those fees. That's the whole part of being, they say middle class, but I still say it's poor. It's the poor and it's the rich. There's no middle.
So, you know, me and school and stuff, I know that can be a big toll on you too financially. So how are you taking that?
You know, I just pray on it. And, you know, God have done so many things for me. And I know that he's going to work this out for us too. If you are accepted into a college, we're going to find a way to make it happen. Because then you're going to be the first of my children to get a college degree. The thing that I hope is that you start applying for some scholarships. You're very articulate, and you're a great writer when you put your mind into it. That, and we'll try to go for grants. I may have to take a loan out for you to go to school. I don't know. That's the future.
Yeah.
That's the future, and it's just unfortunate that I was unable to really put aside money for college for you. But, you know, I just didn't have it like that. When, you know, when I was growing up, although I had my grandmother to show us about shopping and stuff, but to get the backgrounds about budgeting and what finance truly is and about your credit rating and all that, really, I didn't have anybody to show me that, you know, and teach me that. I'm learning about finances as I go. You know, people think because you're grown that you should know. But if you're not exposed and if you're not taught, you don't know.
When we had that conversation, it kind of reminded me of, like, when I was younger, how we used to talk. Because we used to talk like that. And we don't do that anymore because, I don't know, like, I be mad or she be mad about something and it comes up in the conversation and then we end up arguing or something. So it's like, but seeing my mom struggle is a huge portion of why I try to control my financial life as much as possible. The world is out to get your money and your financial life. Don't let them control it.
That piece was produced by Lisa Morehouse and Game Theory Academy, which is a financial education program for young adults. You can find out more about them at kalw.org. And if you want to tell us how you learned to handle money, you can share your story at our Facebook page. We're KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. What we learn from our families is often very private. It's knowledge we keep inside of us. Filmmaker Mark DeSena is hoping to open a window onto that kind of family life with his new film, The War Inside, involving his own childhood home movies. The film's a project of the Center for Asian American Media, or CAM, which is hosting its 31st annual festival this year and launching a new national initiative to collect and preserve Asian American home movies. KALW's Ben Trefney spoke with DeSena about the value of finally bringing these national memories to light and DeSena's personal contribution to the collection.
You know, it's what's really interesting seeing your home movies, especially, and it's, you know, a personal journey in many ways. My family, my parents were separated when I was young. My mom brought us here. And, you know, she didn't have any desire to, you know, hold on to our cultural identity. She wanted us to fit in. She wanted us to assimilate. So, you know, other than eating Japanese food and being around my brothers, I didn't really have that cultural identity of being Asian. So seeing the home movies, like, hey, there I am as a baby. So I've been Asian all my life. Here you go. So it's, you know, it's been interesting to sort of reawaken that. And it, from that, seeing those films, I've developed a theme for my presentation, and I'm calling it The War Inside.
The War Inside, as you struggle with identity?
Yes. So my father is Filipino and my mom is Japanese. So when you think about it, the invasion of the Philippines by the Japanese, Bataan Death March, a lot of atrocities, it just, within 7 years of the war being over, my parents somehow found each other and fell in love. But, you know, hello, Bataan Death March, atrocities, why are you finding each other? You know, isn't there this, you know, leftover hostility? And, you know, it's a bit of a comedy in a way, because I'm sort of riffing on, you know, they shouldn't have got together and therefore I'm this tortured soul. And I do find there's personality differences within myself, and I'm maybe looking to attribute those to maybe some of those cultural differences as well.
There's something about how this is bringing out the home life for Asian Americans as part of this festival, but that's something that's often been quite private. I was wondering if you can elaborate about that and the significance of a project like Memories to Light in sharing stories and giving more insight into what, you know, for a lot of people has been kind of more of a hidden private culture.
Mm-hmm. And what they're really trying to do, Center for Asian American Media, is to open up that world for the rest of the world. I think it's, you know, this idea of being Asian American, what does that actually mean? And, you know, for me, it's an exploration of being mixed race. So Asian American for me is being Japanese and Filipino. But for my kids, being Asian American, I married my wife Liz, who is Italian and Irish. So their Asian American experience is going to be Italian, Irish, Japanese, and Filipino. So it's, you know, to me, it's really interesting that it's going to be more Hapa than purebred, I think, eventually. I mean, that seems to be the direction of the entire world is taking. So, you know, I don't know if that's their intent, but I see that is, you know, an inevitability that's going to happen.
That's filmmaker Mark DeSena. He is going to be presenting Memories to Light, which is part of the Center for Asian American Media Film Festival. It's a closing night production. Let's take a listen to one of the movies that's been contributed to this product. This is actually by your composer in this and one of the project managers, Davin Agatep. And it's taken from his own family's home video collection, as all of the films are from Memories to Light. It's audio from him in 1986 talking about his Christmas presents. Let's take a listen.
Hello. Today is Christmas Day. Today, this is for me that my brother Dennis gave me. It's Winnie the Pooh. Next, this is my brother. It's 10 TDK tapes. Next, this is my my headset, which is like a radio, only a headset. Next, we have money. Next, we have the zero-gravity cliffhangers that I got for Christmas. And boy, is it huge. Next, we got this super holler twin-pack truck. It's remote-controlled, too. Next, over here, how am I going to carry this?
That's the voice of a very young Davin Agatep as he's opening Christmas presents or talking about them. He's actually kind of acting there. So what does this tape say to you? What does that home movie say to you?
Seeing these films again, it just reopens this sort of picture of home that you just have completely forgot about. When I saw our films too, and, you know, the memories of being in Panama and, you know, being in Oakland, and, you know, that there were just blurs in our mind. Like, it's so different from today where you can, you know, everybody's got a camera. They can, you know, we have hours of video footage of our son growing up, of him just, you know, sitting there in his crib. Whereas, you know, all you had before were still shots.
Well, for you, how has this experience then of exploring this maybe more deeply because of looking at your historical video and thinking more about this history and your parents' relationship, what has that meant for you in your life?
Well, I think, you know, my parents were divorced when I was very young, so I think it's a bit of a forgiveness that I'm going to explore with my parents' separation. My dad in particular, I didn't grow up with my dad, and he came back into our lives late and had his own life, and we had ours. So it's that personal trip exploration that I'm going to take that maybe gets me to that point of, you know, I can forgive him and, you know, forgive myself, forgive a lot of things that you know, I think we harbor inside of ourselves, you know, and try to keep them down. And this was, you know, a way to say, hey, there's first time I've ever seen my mom and dad kiss. There it is on film. And, you know, like, I don't remember that at all.
Filmmaker Mark DeSena spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. DeSena will present his film, The War Inside, at the New People Cinema in San Francisco this coming Sunday, March 24th at 5 p.m. Memories to Light is an ongoing project designed to archive as many Asian American home movies as possible. So if you've got films stored away collecting dust, go to kalw.org to find out how you can contribute to the project. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Nina Gensler-Debs, Erica Mu, Laura Saponara, Ava Sonsen, Judy Silber, Resu Sussman, Stephen Short, Brooke Welty, and Mary Willis. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KALW is listener-supported independent radio. The atmospheric sounds you're hearing now are by the Dandelion War. They're performing at Café du Nord in San Francisco this Thursday, starting around 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. Oh, no, it's not love.